on the latest Bigfoot Collectors Club, The Other Side. It's a Bigfoot Book Club episode where we discuss the survival horror slash Bigfoot thriller Devolution by Max Brooks. Also in this episode, the truth about eating on camera. Visit patreon.com/Bigfoot Collectors Club for more info.
Bigfoot Collectors Club presents
Terrifying Tales from Zombie Bigfoot's Cryptid Crypt! I know a ghost story about you!
Welcome to another episode of Bigfoot Collectors Club. I'm your host, Michael McMillan. Unfortunately, absent from today's episode is your other host, Bryce Johnson. He's unavailable due to mysterious reasons that we cannot go into. But thankfully, filling in for Bryce is, of course, our super producer,
Riley Bray.
We have a great show for you today, but before we introduce today's amazing guest, we're kicking off a new month-long Halloween event for October that we're calling Terrifying Tales from Zombie Bigfoot's Cryptid Crypt. All month long, here on the main feed and on the other side, our stories of high strangeness will be scarier and more horrifying than usual to embrace that Halloween spirit. We have some really cool things planned, including some upcoming brand new merch. So give us a follow on Twitter at Bigfoot Pod and on Instagram at Bigfoot Collectors Club and stay tuned for that announcement. Okay, here we go. Today's guest is a comedy writer, a podcaster, and co-host of the world-famous Doughboys podcast and the smash hit video game podcast, How Did This Get Played? Boys and girls, please give a warm Club Scout salute to Mr. Nick Weiger.
All right.
Hi.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. I told you this off air, but I will reiterate it. Both Doughboys and How Did This Get Played are on my subscription list on my podcast app. I listen every week, and I love both shows.
That's very, very nice of you. I appreciate that.
So you're obviously a fast food connoisseur.
Yes.
Is there a horror-themed, like, fast food item that you can remember? Is there, like, a spooky Halloween treat that you like the most?
You know, this isn't fast food, but as far as junk food snacks go, in that category, you can always think of the Halloween cereals. You got your Count Chocula, your Boo Berry, your Frankenberry, and your Yummy Mummy.
Oh, yeah, so, baby.
And then Fruit Brute, who's kind of their take on a Frankenstein. That's where my mind goes immediately. As far as fast food, I'm sure there have been some promotional tie-ins with horror properties, but the ones that I think of are like King Kong. I think had some that doesn't really tie into the paranormal, but I mean, like King Kong,
he's
Godzilla.
Sort of like a giant Bigfoot.
Yes, yeah, he is a giant Bigfoot. Godzilla, there was a, you know, the Taco Bell promotion for that.
Oh, yeah.
I had do you remember the movie Congo, the Michael Crichton adaptation from the 90s? I had the Congo promotional Taco Bell watch, and I was wearing that for a while. Which is very
awesome.
Exciting. Yeah.
Amy the talking gorilla.
Yes, yeah, 100. Yeah, Amy, she drinks a martini in the film in a practical gag designed by the late magician Ricky Jay.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that complicated to have a guy in a gorilla suit drink a martini on camera, but apparently it involved outside consultation.
I mean, I guess so, because if you really want to make it, usually in that you just see, like, the Muppets will just throw it in their faces or something,
right?
You know what I mean? Like Cookie Monster, just the cookies go all outside, they go crumbling outside of his mouth. So to have an animatronic or a suit like that actually drink something, I guess, would take a bit of wizardry.
I guess so.
My favorite all-time fast food tie-in was the Triple Hero Burger that came out during Batman Forever at McDonald's. It was like three hamburger patties lined up on a McRib bun. And I think it was one of the only McDonald's burgers that I remember ever having mayo on it. So it was like a little weird, but I loved it. And that's when I discovered that I had a an affection for mayo on my burgers.
I have a vague recollection of that, but it's rare for McDonald's to introduce a menu item specifically for a tie-in. Usually it'll just be like a Happy Meal toy.
Yeah, no, so they really went something. They went all out, and I was in high school at the time, and I think I went in through the drive-thru after school every day. I guess it was the summertime, so it was after work. I would just go. I got one of those like every day. It was disgusting, but God, I still think about that burger. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Video game wise, what are some of your favorite? I'm putting you on the spot here. I apologize. What are some of your favorite horror-based video games?
Great question. You know, a recent one that I love and that I've raved about on my podcast along with Heather Ann Gamble and Matt Apodaca, who I do the show with, is a Death Stranding, Hideo Kojima's game, which is it's sci-fi apocalyptic but has strong horror elements, and it has these creatures called. The lore of this game is incomprehensible, which I love. I love just how complicated it is. I love that I spent near 100 hours playing it, and I still can't really explain what's going on right in my wheelhouse. But so Kojima has this thing called, because it's just all, there's so much world building, and there's so much, it's just a barrage of new ideas. And one of them is these things called BTs, beached things, which are like these otherworldly, they're like basically things that have died but have passed on to the next world, but you can still have some sort of interaction with, you know, it's a fucking ghost. That's fundamentally what it is. But you need a baby that has been born to a dead mother, I believe, in order to detect them. Because you need that connection to the outer, you need that like that link. That umbilical link to the other side. So it's got this layer of like you're carrying a baby around that you have mounted on your your like sci-fi exoskeleton, and the baby will start crying and detecting when there are BTs nearby, when there are beached things, and then you can use your device I think it's called the Obra deck. What the fuck's it called? You use this thing to shoot out waves, and then you can see the BTs, and they are horrifying. They're extremely scary.
Aren't they like big dinosaur-like creatures or something?
Yeah, they're gigantic hulking abominations. But then also occasionally you'll run across like when you get closer to them, you can see they have more of a humanoid form. And then sometimes you will run across a baby. Like that is like it's the same thing, and it's a baby, and then the way you kill them is you sever their umbilical cord to the other side.
Of course.
Anyway, it's so complicated, but it's really great, and it's really immersive, I think, because like you're just like thinking about all these concepts the whole time.
Man, I've listened to you guys talk about this on the show, and I have not played Death Stranding yet. And the more I hear you guys talk about it, the more I feel like I need to pick it up. I'm fascinated by the idea of like the scientists in that world who A, discovered the BTs, and then B, discovered how the method of detecting them was babies. You know, like who Yes. figured out that science?
It's just so complicated, but everyone just like you'll hear something like that. There'll be like this large amount of exposition, which will come from a lot of times from a character named Die Hard Man, and Die Hard Man, who is the president, and
of course,
and wears a mask that covers the lower half of his face. The game came out before COVID, by the way. But anyway, so this mask wearing president named Die Hard Man will give you 5 minutes worth of exposition explaining a new concept, and everyone will just take it in stride. No one's ever like that's weird. It's just like, all right, sure, whatever.
I just love that like everything you just described would not make it past like the pitch session of a TV writer's room. Like you would be fired immediately if you pitched any of these concepts.
I love it. I mean, Kojima is like Hideo Kojima, who is the designer of this game, who's most famous for the Metal Gear Solid series, he has this like auteur sort of status, the stature, and he has his own company now, Kojima Productions, where he's kind of crossed the George Lucas threshold, where he just now has total creative freedom and no one to say no to any of his ideas. And as a result, you just get like total anarchy as his output, but it's great because you're not going to see like just a pure stream of someone's ideas, someone's like brain dump. Really, it you see it so few places in any medium.
Totally.
That's a good point, yeah.
Oh, man, I got to check that out. I think my favorite horror game memory is when I think it's the first scary game I ever played was Resident Evil 4 on the GameCube.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when I bought it at the electronics counter at Target. I will never forget this. And the guy, the like teenager who was checking me out was like, oh, yeah. He's like, whew, get ready for this one. I was like, really? And he's like, oh, man, this game is terrifying. And so I was like, really getting, really building me up as I bought it. I was almost like second guessing my purchase. And then as I was walking away, he goes, hey. And I turn around. And he goes, there's a shotgun in the tower in the village. You're going to need it. And I was just, and he was right. Like, I remember being like, oh, there's the tower. I went up there and there was a shotgun. And it was like the only way to get through that village was to get that shotgun. But it was just like that classic moment of like the old man on the edge of the forest warning me not to go up to the haunted castle.
Yeah, you had a real life NPC.
Yeah, totally.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a cool story. It is one of my favorite memories, let alone video game memories, but what a blast. That game was so good. All right, Nick, well, we love to ask all of our guests, what is your personal paranormal history? Do you believe in ghosts? Have you encountered a ghost? Have you seen a UFO? Any of this stuff?
I don't really believe in ghosts, and I'm not like a huge like annoying skeptic about it, but I don't really believe it. UFOs, aliens, you know, again, I think I'm one of the people who tends to just buy whatever line is like, well, this was actually just a high speed aircraft that was being tested at low altitude or whatever. Like, I'll just be like, all right, sure. Yeah, that's probably what happened. But I think alien life likely exists, but I don't think it's necessarily visited us. But again, you know, I'm not like a huge annoying skeptic about that. It's possible. I haven't really had any paranormal encounters in person that I've experienced firsthand. However, the thing that's maybe akin to that I've heard discussed in paranormal terms is I have sleep paralysis.
Oh, boy.
Fairly often, less often these days, but had it a lot as a kid. It's still a two or three times a year occurrence for me. And sleep paralysis. Have either of you guys ever experienced it?
Yeah,
I have not, but we've talked. Yeah, Michael has. We've talked.
You've
about
experienced
it a lot
it.
Too.
What? So my experience of it, and I'm curious, Michael, how much yours squares up with it. But I will. It feels interminable. It feels like it's stretching on forever. Like, yeah. I can't move. A lot of times it'll be like I'm like face down on my pillow, like I've rolled onto my stomach, and then that's when I get it. So I literally feel like I can't get air into my body. I can't make my lungs move, and I feel like I'm going to die, and I'm trapped there forever. And then also the other thing that's happened to me a lot with this is that I just get like this huge hulking silhouette. Like it looks like Juggernaut shadow, just like,
whoa,
this gigantic thing with like a not really a head, but just like a gigantic rounded top to his body. Like his torso just kind of goes up and it like a mountain, and then just like huge arms just sort of lurking over me. And
wow.
So that's what I associate. And then I'm just like stuck in that forever. And I am trying weekly to make any sort of noise to alert, you know, somebody to help me to try to get my wife to like wake me up. But no sound comes out of my lungs. It's really, that's the most scared I ever am in my life is when I'm suffering from sleep paralysis. And then, of course, I'm not aware that I'm having sleep paralysis until after the fact.
That's the thing that's always so fucked up about it, and just bad dreams in general, is,
yes,
why, if we've been through this before, why can't our brain just go, oh, Nick, you're just that hulking shadow beast. That's you've seen this before. It's going
right
to go away. Why don't our brains work that way?
It doesn't make any sense. I feel like I should be able to recognize when I'm in a dream anytime I'm in a dream. You know, like I feel like it's like, okay, in what situation would I be making pancakes with my third grade teacher?
Like, I just well, I don't know, Nick.
It's a smooth talking third grader.
We might be getting to the bottom of this these night terrors. The screaming is also the worst part when you're trying to make a sound.
Yes,
it's so bad. Like, and you're married, so I'm this might be presumptuous of me, but I assume your wife is next to you in bed. I sleep alone most of the time, and so the only person I can call to for help is my dog, who's usually next to me, because I think, like, if I can somehow, like, get Violet to wake up, then she'll wake me up. You know what I mean? So I'm always trying to, like, move my hand, and yes, it's just, like, vibrating really badly and not moving, and I'm trying to, like, reach across the covers to find my dog to tap her awake. It's the worst.
It's really, and you know, like, for me, I feel like every muscle's contracted. Like, I can't, like, you know, I can't move anything. When I've had, and I'm not sure if it's sleep paralysis or just other bad dreams, but I've had times when my wife Natalie has woken me up in the middle, and then just sort of, like, known, she's at the point now where she knows to, like, just sort of, like, reassure me and calm me down. Like, it's okay, you're just dreaming, because I'll wake up in a state of complete panic. Mm. But I feel like I can't even muster like a suffering from sleep paralysis. I just can't do anything.
Yeah.
But it's, yes. Yeah. So do you ever see anything? Do you ever hear anything?
Yeah, I'll do. I mean, I've told some of these stories on the show before, but, like, this started when I was really little. And now I'm a grown up and see a therapist, you know, it's 10, you know, basically I've learned that, okay, this is one of the ways that my anxiety manifests itself. Right. Hmm. And when I was a kid, and I was a pretty anxious little kid, like, I remember the earliest versions of this were I would wake up frozen in bed and my eyes weren't open, but I could sense that there were beings around my bed, and I would feel this light sensation up and down my arms. And I was like, they're touching my arms, you know? And that's why when I was, like, in high school, I thought maybe I'd been abducted by aliens.
Right.
But, you know, again, having gone through all this, you know, talk therapy, I'm realizing, like, oh no, this is a pattern that recurred my whole life. And then what would also happen when I was really stressed out, they kind of would move from that, the sleep paralysis. And then the other version I have is that I instantly wake up and see a figure standing next to my bed. When I was a kid, it was E.T. It was a teddy bear that looked like E.T. But in my mind, in my eye, I saw, like, a high def resolution image of E.T. next to my bed.
Yes.
And I would scream, and then instantly it would all vanish. But then I was left with just, like, this adrenaline rushing through my body. That happened to me as a grown up too. I was filming a horror movie in Morocco. I think I told the story fairly recently, but there's a reason why I'm specifically telling you, Nick. I woke up and saw myself covered in blood with a bloody knife standing over my bed in the hotel I was staying in. And I screamed. I, like, threw my pillows, knocked over a lamp, ran. It was so bad that I ran into my bathroom and like, locked myself in. I was, like, cowering in fear.
Jesus, yeah.
And I was just, like, really overworked and tired, and I was in a strange country. And Wes Craven was a producer on this movie, and the next day I was talking to him about it, and he goes, oh, you saw yourself? And I said, yes. And, oh God, what was the name of it that he said? I think he just called it a phantom. He was like, that was your phantom. And next time you see it, ask what it wants. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. Like,
very Wes Craven response.
Yeah, right?
Use it.
Yeah. So maybe next time you see the shadow knot, you know, the big hulking beast, try to ask it in your sleep paralysis, maybe mentally, since you can't move your mouth, you know, what do you want? What do you want? But yeah, I've had those. Yeah, I just need a friend. I've had tons of that stuff. Usually sleep paralysis will hit me when I nap in the middle of the day.
Okay.
And I feel like I will be in not a terrified version of it, but I'm frozen and I will see out of the corner of my eye people come into my room and walk around my room and have conversations that I don't understand.
I basically never nap, but when I have had naps, especially when I was younger, when it was more common, yeah, I would have it happen sometimes too. I think maybe a trigger for it could be just like getting really hot, maybe.
Right.
Maybe that's something that causes it. I have definitely had an element of it where I'm like, I'm in my bedroom, I'm in wherever I'm sleeping, and I can't move, and yeah, stuff is happening around me. Whether it's the recurring looming hulking presence, or just something else, some other dreamlike thing that I just have no capability to react to. It's funny that you mentioned the ET thing from childhood, because I had a similar thing. So that same sort of specter that I see, it originally appeared to me when I was like, I think maybe 4 or 5, and it was like golden. It was like, whoa. Just like, it was like, you know, shining brightly like the sun and like coming towards me. And I remember telling my parents about it in the morning. It was just like this terrifying experience. And they were trying to calm me down. They were just like, oh, it was probably Big Bird. And I remember.
That's even worse.
Yeah, I remember. Horrifying. Well, this is the thing, because I just remember being like just knowing in my head. And I just be like, it's not fucking Big Bird. Don't tell me it's Big Bird. And always saw.
Feed me these cover up lies.
Stop telling me the Sesame Street bullshit. I'm living a nightmare. Were your parents religious at all? Were you raised religious?
Yes, we were Episcopalian, you know, which is kind of like Catholicism light. And we went regularly. I almost just said we went religiously, which, yes, we did. We went regularly to church basically until my brother became a teenager. And then maybe it was just too much of a hassle. And then we stopped going. I don't think my parents are really religious anymore, but they both kind of grown up with it. My mom especially. And so just kind of continued that. So yeah, Christianity was like a big part again, like it, not, you know, not like Episcopalianism is, it's like the, one of the looser sects, you know, it's one of the, more lenient, more progressive sects. And so, S-E-C-T-S, yes. I'm trying to say. And so it was never like it's still a pretty liberal, progressive household. But yeah, that was definitely we definitely were a church-going family.
Because I just feel like the golden light thing that a lot of parents would be like, it was an angel, Nick.
Oh,
Nick,
yes,
it was an angel. An angel came to visit you. You know, I don't know why your parents are from Texas, but...
I never thought of it in terms of in religious terms. You know, at any time I've had something like that, I thought it would be, maybe paranormal or maybe extraterrestrial. And then later I just realized, it's just a dream thing.
There is the mythology of light beings that we haven't gotten really too much into on the show, but it's sort of a new age take on aliens, that there are beings of light, like highly intelligent, highly spiritual. They're not angels, but they're kind of like the sci-fi version of them that will sometimes, you know, bless people with their presence and download, you know, positive information or emotion. So it's so fascinating that this juggernaut, just from a psychology point of view, that this thing went from like super golden to like now it's a dark shadow.
Now it's a shadow, yeah.
So what do you guys think these things are? Like, you know, you'd say it's a dream thing or it's from your anxiety, but is this just entirely like something that's coming out of your subconscious, do you think? And why is it so sort of uniform, the experience that people have that experience this?
Other things I've read is that it's a lot of times people will perceive like a long, stretched out sort of apparition. Have you heard this before?
Yeah.
With a hat sometimes.
Yeah, like super elongated. Yeah, yes, 100%. I don't know. I don't know what it is. I do remember reading, and Michael, you probably know more about this, but I remember reading a book when I was younger, perhaps by Carl Sagan, that talked about alien abductions from a skeptical perspective, and was basically saying that a lot of times postulating that these are just, you know, episodes of sleep paralysis or flat out nightmares that people were, you know, retconning into being alien abductions, and then pointed to the same sort of phenomenon happening centuries earlier, but everyone attributed it to angels or, you know, a succubi or something.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Because it was before the idea of extraterrestrials were in the collective consciousness, so people just sought something else out. Now, of course, someone who's bullish on aliens will just say, like, well, they just didn't know what aliens were, and they were still getting abducted back then. But I still don't know why the experience is so uniform.
Yeah, that's the whole Jacques Vallée point of view. Well, Jacques Vallée, the writer, wrote Passport to Magonia, and he basically traces these extraterrestrial encounters all the way back to biblical times. And it's like they were angels and demons, they were succubi, then they were fairies, now they're aliens.
Got it.
And for a brief period, they were like, people from San Francisco flying around in like magical airships, you know, before the airplane was invented.
Ah,
you know, so there's just like strange history of the phenomenon, you know, and then, but even in that, you'll get some like, they aren't all sleep paralysis things. They're like living, breathing, waking interactions or encounters, you know, with some sort of manifestation of some kind, whether it's a hallucination or it's some sort of, you know, extra dimensional intelligence manifesting itself. Because, you know, one of the things that I think about, Nick, I'd actually be interested to hear your perspective on this in terms of just nature of reality in general, is this idea of the simulation theory. That this reality that we're living in here, that this world is, might just be a highly advanced computer simulation that our consciousness is dropping down into, and we're experiencing much the way that we would experience an avatar in a video game, but it's just so advanced that we've sort of forgotten that we're playing that game or that we're living in that simulation. Because again, like you pointed out, why don't we know that we're dreaming, you know?
Right. My thing on the simulation theory is it's almost, I guess this is a cop out, but it's almost like irrelevant to our lived experiences, right? It's just like there's just no, it doesn't, how can it affect anything? And is it less meaningful ultimately if it is just a simulation? You know, I don't know. I feel like this is, I still feel like life is worth something, even if it is just like, I guess, you know, it essentially someone else's creation. I don't know. I feel like there's no real way to know. I probably am, again, you know, I fall on the skeptical side, but not completely ruling it out. I would love to die and be greeted with an end of life stats screen that has, yeah, all the names I've learned, all the number of dogs I've petted, you know, just a kind of summation of all my experiences. And then I'd love to start a new game plus and just sort of have all the knowledge in my head of what my life's going to be and try to do a better job.
Oh my God. That's such a great way of looking at it. And then what, and then like, but you never defeated the Shadow Juggernaut. So you have to go back that if you want like that. If you want to go platinum, you have to beat the Shadow Juggernaut.
There's a whole quest line I missed at like age 7. You're like, look for this time.
They were like, we kept giving you hints, Nick, and you just kept screaming into the void, into your pillow, instead of confronting it. Yeah, I don't know.
Where do you stand, Michael?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think such a majority of this stuff comes from our subconscious or unconscious or the Jungian collective unconscious, you know, that there's so many forms that just universally that, you know, we're all different people, but we all basically have the same hardware, you know, so I'm not surprised that so much of the hardware outputs, you know, creates, you know, this similar visions or similar nightmares. And, you know, God, as you were talking about the stretched out thing, I was listening to a podcast and now I can't remember whose it was. So I was like, maybe Marcy and Betsy's. I don't know. Maybe it was on one. I don't know why it would be on one of your shows, but there is this. I recently heard this theory that humans are really bad at creating faces in their mind's eye, so that when you are hallucinating, you're seeing like shadow beings. They'll oftentimes be stretched out or elongated as your like mind's eye is trying to create a face that you can actually look at. So that sort of might what creates the shadow being, or the man in the hat, or the man in the tall hat that stretches out, you know. But then again, if you look at it from the flip side, we have a recurring guest on the show. She's a medium and an intuitive named Dayla Levine. And she's very talented. She's very cool. She's very smart. She's down to earth. And she tends to float that, well, when we're in the sleep state, we're also in a different state of consciousness that does allow us to peek into, you know, the other realm, or the spirit realm, or the dream world, and that it's an altered state of consciousness that does allow you to see behind the veil a little bit. So it's possible that there is some sort of consciousness behind that shadow juggernaut that's hanging out with you. You know what I mean?
Wow.
There might be some validity to Wes Craven telling me, ask it what it wants.
Yeah. I kind of wonder if maybe it just can't be both, you know, like if you accept that there's a multiverse and then there's this sort of infinite potential, then, you know, if you're having a hallucination, but that hallucination is seeing a potential reality. So maybe, you know, it's sort of that, you know, maybe the dream world or whatever is kind of our playground for looking at the multiverse or something like that. And then these sleep paralysis things are you know, that little bit of crossover, that spillover in the line between the two. And, you know, so it is just based on our, you know, like you said, our hardware, like our brains and how they work. But maybe we are also seeing something that's beyond just this reality.
Do these theories stack? Is there anyone who's like, we are in a simulation and that explains the alternate universes because those are different versions of the simulation being run that you can some, you know, like are there, I don't know how, to, at what layer or what level these things start being layered upon atop each other.
Yeah. That's,
I think you just did it. Well,
yeah, oh, wow. Okay. I think that's the Weiger theory.
Yeah. I
attribute
like
that to
a lot,
me on Spookypedia or whatever the site is that people use.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I think that maybe it's maybe some of these like aliens or creatures are either bots in the game, you know, or sprites that can interact with us the way, you know, that they're sort of like programmed in there. I don't know enough about coding, obviously, to really go much further than that. Or it's the game developer dropping in to interact with us in a sort of like modded form, you know. I don't know. Or it's like, what happens when, you know, we're on sleep mode in the simulation and we're getting just like glimpses of the other dimension or the higher dimension where our consciousness, you know, drops in from to run around in these meat suit avatars.
Right.
It's like the upper levels you haven't unlocked yet.
Yeah, or like what we'll go back to when we wake up, right? when it's game over time. Yeah, or, you know, I don't know. It's memories of, you know, because sometimes I like to think that we existed before we were born, and the choice is like, yeah, let's go down and let's fuck it. You know, much in the same way that we get into movies or video games or books here and we can really escape into them. They're stories, you know, obviously.
Yes.
There's something that we get meaning from stories. And let's say that we exist before we were born. We're in like whatever the heaven dimension is, or the fifth dimension, whatever you want to call it. And we go, hey, let's, you know what? I'm going to drop down. I'm going to go spend, you know, 60 to 90 Earth years playing in the third dimension as a guy named Michael, or I don't even know who I'm going to end up. I don't know. It's a random generator what avatar I get. But then once I'm down there, I'm going to have to stay down there until I get killed. And because we're playing in the third dimension, it's no holds barred. Like, the best shit can happen, and also the worst shit can happen. And the catch is, I'm not going to remember that I'm playing a game here. I'm not going to remember any of this stuff until I die and I wake back up and I'm like, oh, right, that's what I was doing.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty next level game, yeah. Honestly. It's a cool idea.
Go on, please.
No, I was just going to say, to answer your question earlier, I don't know if there's a difference. You know, when you get into this stuff, then really what's the difference between that and the biblical image of what Earth is? You know, that there's a creator, that we're sent, we're souls that are staying here, and then when we die, we're going to rejoin with the creator. You know what I mean? It's right. Not really that different. It's just a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I guess going back to dreams, it's the same sort of thing where, like, you're within a dream, you don't realize you're in a dream, you made this point earlier, and then you wake up and all of a sudden you're just like, oh, that's what that was, you know, and I like, it's just like the idea that you would, a life would end and you'd just sort of be like, okay, I'm this fucking weird tentacle guy who's been playing this game for 80 Earth years. And then I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's what was happening. I remember I logged into this a while back.
Right. And if you're living in a dimension that's outside time, you know, you might be logging into this for what feels like 30 minutes. But for us feels, you know, while you're down here, it feels like 90 years.
Right.
But I also love the idea of like waking up and being like, oh, fuck, I'm a disgusting tentacle creature. I forgot.
Oh, yeah. I really look like shit.
Oh, man.
That's why I wanted this escape.
Yeah. Okay. I gotta go again.
Yeah. You just like crush an energy drink and like go back to playing the games.
It's interesting that because some of the things that are, you know, just expanding on what you guys were saying, like some the equivalent of what the simulation would be, like an MMO, like, you know, classic example, World of Warcraft has elements of, if you die in World of Warcraft, you become like an observer, and then you're just sort of walking, you know, your job then is you can't really interact with the world in the same way, but you can move around and eventually retrieve your corpse and then re-enter the world of the living. And, you know, that's the thing a lot of games have, which is like, okay, that's partly, I get, you know, that's informed, I guess, by, you know, mythology and folklore and what we have. But I mean, I guess there's a world where, like, what we have in our world was created as part of the simulation, you know, the idea that like ghosts are appearing and stuff, like that's like that's an element that was just designed in,
right?
Because you see it in games that get designed now, and so it's, you know, like it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, I guess.
Yeah, and it's like the Fallout 76 stuff where you can find cryptids, you can find sheep squatch, you can find, like, you know, the Snallygaster and stuff. It's just,
have you been playing Fallout 76?
I haven't, but we've had a lot of listeners and research. It pops up in our research all the time, just because now there's so many of these cryptids in that game. Should I be playing it?
I haven't played it because it got such, it was completely panned at launch.
Yeah.
And I guess it's one of those ones where they've updated it a few times and now it's a lot more playable. So maybe I'll explore it. I do like the Fallout universe a lot. But I was just so turned off by the initial impressions.
Yeah, me too. That's why I didn't pick it up. But now I'm like, I don't know if Bigfoot's in this thing. I kind of want to play it. Like, I would just play it just so I could go find the cryptids.
Right.
And there's some really obscure ones in there, too. Like the Grafton Monster that, like, you know, it's probably one of our least listened to episodes.
Deep cut. Deep cut for sure.
What's the Grafton Monster?
Grafton Monster was in, I think it was, it might have been Ohio. Let me take a look about where Grafton was. But it oddly, strangely, and I did not plan this, Nick, it's a hulking-like creature that seems to have no head.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot like the Juggernaut. If you're near a computer, just Google Grafton Monster.
I'm going to do that real quick.
And the first thing you're going to get is the Grafton Monster from the Fallout 76, because now there's more stuff about that on the internet than the actual Grafton Monster. But it was in the West Virginia hills.
This is the fucking thing,
dude. Oh,
this is so similar to what I see. It's, you know, the Fallout version is asymmetrical, which is not my experience. But this I'm looking at some of the other artist renderings of it.
I'll read you a description that I just pulled off a random website. This is from West Virginia Explorer. the Grafton Monster, formerly a railroad boomtown, Grafton, West Virginia, today seems somewhat an anomaly, a village of big city architecture locked in a territory of small farms and dense woodlands. Through these woodlands prowls a monster, some say. The legend of the Grafton Monster has endured since the 1960s when sightings were at their peak. The man-like beast is said to be akin to a Bigfoot or skunk ape. According to the book Monsters of West Virginia, eyewitnesses have estimated that it stands between 7 and 9 feet tall.
Wow.
And is cloaked in pale skin that is slick like that of a seal. But it has no discernible like head, like its head is hunched down, embedded like in its shoulders and chest.
Can I just say real quick to the Grafton Monster, if you're listening to this podcast, just leave me alone. Get out of my dreams.
Or Lick. I'm a big bird. I'm not.
All right, Nick, we have a game that we like to play with all of our guests on the show. I'm going to go down a list of phenomenon. And if you're into it or open to it, you're going to say believe it. If you're not, you're going to say bullshit. This is a game that we like to call bullshit
or believe it.
All right, Nick Weiger, on your mark. Oh, I forgot to mention, this is our spooky Halloween edition that's come back after a year of absence.
Awesome.
Here we go. On your mark, get set. Ghosts.
Bullshit.
UFOs.
Bullshit.
Bigfoot.
Bullshit.
Vampires.
I wish it wasn't, but bullshit.
Shadow people.
I think I have to go believe it.
Yes, you do.
Loch Ness Monster.
Bullshit.
Little gray aliens.
Bullshit.
Werewolves.
Bullshit.
Parallel universes.
Believe it.
Zombies.
Bullshit.
Shapeshifters.
Bullshit.
Heaven.
Believe it.
Hell.
Bullshit.
Yeti.
Bullshit.
Doppelgangers.
Bullshit.
Astrology.
Bullshit.
ESP.
Bullshit.
Witches.
Bullshit.
Demons.
Bullshit.
Atlantis.
Bullshit.
Mothman.
Bullshit.
Reincarnation.
Believe it.
The apocalypse.
Believe it.
Life after death.
Believe it.
Well done, Nick Weiger. You got through bullshit or believe it. I also enjoyed how lower your voice got with every bullshit.
Very bullshit.
Trying to sound like Riley for a second.
Oh boy, we all wish we could. Witches. I feel like you upset a lot of people out there by saying witches were bullshit.
I maybe regret that, just because the witch community might come after me in earnest and
prove that got a hex on your head.
Bullshit. Yeah.
Astrology, you know, that's a dangerous position in Los Angeles to call bullshit.
Yes. Well, I mean, I know some people who do astrology and you know, I think just being confronted with a binary of true or false, I'm going to be a little bit more inherently skeptical, but you know, I think I'm open to most things. For me, the clearest bullshits are like the Loch Ness Monster and Atlantis. Those are ones where just like, come on. Everything else, I'm just like, well, you know, I guess there's a possibility.
Atlantis is just, I mean, and we really haven't done a big research on this. So, you know what, guys, I might change my mind. But just from its popularity at the turn of the century and during like the New Age wave that was happening in the 20s and 30s, Atlantis really just seems to be like a made up place where white people can say they descended from. You know what I mean?
It's like white Wakanda.
We're like, yeah, it's like, I don't know, guys. This is just I don't know. You're from Western Europe. That's where you're from. You're not. Right. You're not like ascended from high masters of a highly advanced society. I'm sorry. I think the results are in the pudding here, everybody.
Yeah, no kidding.
That said, I will say there is an Indiana Jones video game, Indiana yes! Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, which rules.
God, I always wanted to play that game. Was that PC or was that Sega?
It was PC.
It was something that I could not play it on. And I remember going to Babbage's at the mall and staring. Babbage's. Yeah, remember Babbage's?
Yes.
Oh, I used to go stare at the, I would stare at the back of the Indiana Jones box, the Atlantis one. And just be like, oh man, I wish I could play it. Because back then, it's like, that's as good as a sequel of a movie. Yes. You know, and it's like another Indiana Jones adventure, please.
And it's, then it's well written too. It's like, it's not a movie caliber, but it's like, it's got a good script.
Oh man. And then the other box that I would stare at, and only the front of it because I was too scared to pick it up, was, of course, Leisure Suit Larry.
Yes. Yeah, the all time horniest. I think it's the horniest I've ever been is looking at Leisure Suit Larry box. I will say that is a thing that I miss about retail, because I love, you know, obviously digital delivery is so much more convenient, but man, the idea of going to a video game store and then just like looking at boxes of games you covet but cannot buy,
right?
Cannot play for what you don't have that system, you know. Or you like it, I, there's something to just like the temptation of that I'm denied this thing, but I just want it, like I'm gonna crave it so much. I don't know. And like you have positive memories of that.
Yeah.
One thing I'll say about Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, which is it's great because it's, you know, it's a point and click adventure game, so it's got like these puzzles that you solve. But if you think of them in terms of it happening in an Indiana Jones movie, it's so bananas. For instance, there's a time there you smuggle yourself aboard a U-boat, which is, you know, very Indiana Jones. You could absolutely see that happening. Mm-hmm. But then there's a point where you have to distract one of the guards who's on the U-boat, and the way you do it is by making a tasty sandwich. And so you find some salami and you like find some bread and you find some like condiments and you like assemble a sandwich and you leave it out. And he's like, that sandwich looks good. And then he's so distracted by the sandwich he's eating that you can sneak past him. Just imagine like Harrison Ford shooting that scene.
Marion, pass me the honey mustard. I need it now. Throw me the mayo. Don't look at it. Don't look at it, Marion.
that's some like Maniac Mansion level antics. Yes. That's
yeah. I mean, and it's the same sort of the same engine and probably some overlapping developers. You know, is the same formula, but just very funny to see it applied to Indiana Jones.
Just made by a programmer who hadn't eaten all day. He's just like just creeped into the game. He's just like, I want a sandwich so bad, but I got to turn this in. Oh, that's so great. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it's time for this week's story of high strangeness with Mr. Nick Weiger. All right, Riley, let's open Zombie Bigfoot's cryptid crypt for this week's terrifying tale.
Here we go.
Here we go. Go, Riley. Give us some spooky music.
And we're off.
In 1924, a classic Beaux Arts-style multi-story hotel in downtown Los Angeles was erected. Within 5 years of its founding, the U.S. slid into the Great Depression and began slowly dragging the surrounding area of the hotel into decline. By the mid-1940s, it was said that more than 10,000 homeless people lived within its one-mile radius. As Skid Row grew around this once luxurious destination for tourists and businessmen alike, the hotel drifted into dreaded decline. It became a home for transients, drifters, and criminals, as well as the elderly and the economically vulnerable. It rented rooms to at least two serial killers. By 1960, the amount of death associated with the building, often self-inflicted by its guests, earned the hotel its gruesome nickname, The Suicide. Should it come as any surprise that this place was highly regarded to be cursed and haunted? In fact, in 2014, a young boy by the name of Costin Alderte snapped an image of a spectral figure hovering outside a window of this infamous LA location. When interviewed by the local news about his ghost photo, which you can see on our Instagram, young Costin had this to say.
When I looked at that window, it just looked kind of creepy to me, and I showed my friend and he kind of freaked out. It just creeps me out still.
It's just a very vague description of a ghost photo. Yeah. Kind of creepy.
Yeah, I don't know. My friend thought it was creepy, too.
Kind of weird. Just sort of freaked out by it. It's like this little boy who's got a ghost on camera. And the photo is odd. It's got a, you know, you can sort of see an image of what looks to be like a foggy figure sort of hovering outside the window. But who knows?
Fair warning. Should I have taken that as like a little kid voice?
Is no, I kind of like that he was a grown man now. That reflecting. Seeing that ghost really, you know, he had to grow up quickly after encountering this photograph.
It gets you fast once you've seen that window ghost.
Fair warning, dear listeners. A spooky ghost photo is the only cute part of tonight's story of high strangeness. What lies ahead is a dark tale full of tragedy and horror. While we will not relish in its violence, we will also not shy away from the hotel's grim history, all too strange and all too real. Consider this your warning. This is the horror story of the Cecil Hotel.
Yes, we're waiting for this one.
The earliest reported suicide at the Cecil Hotel was in 1931. When a hotel guest from Manhattan Beach, W.K. Norton, offed himself by ingesting a handful of poison capsules. The suicides continued through the 1930s, as the Cecil became a notorious location for jumpers, guests who flung themselves from their hotel room windows. One of these victims was Pauline Otten, who, on October 12, 1962, flung herself from a ninth-story window after having an argument with her estranged husband. She fell to the city sidewalk below, where she landed on a 65-year-old pedestrian named George Gianni, killing him in the act. I mean, that's a bad day in your simulation. Like, that's how you go out? It's like a lady falls on you and you're dead?
You've lived your whole life, you got that far, and then this lady from the sky. That's crazy.
In one of the more gruesome and tragic tales in the hotel occurred in 1944, when a hotel guest, Dorothy Jean Purcell, suddenly woke in the middle of the night with terrible stomach aches. She crawled into the bathroom when, much to her surprise, she gave birth to a baby boy. Having no idea she was even pregnant, the delirious woman, mistakenly under the belief that the infant had died in childbirth, flung the newborn out the window. Arrested for her son's murder, Purcell was acquitted at trial for reasons of temporary insanity. She was admitted to a hospital for psychiatric evaluation. Another infamous death is the unsolved murder of Goldie Osgood, also known to locals as the Pigeon Goldie. Osgood was a regular at Pershing Square Park, a retired telephone operator who spent her free time feeding the pigeons. Osgood was discovered dead in a hotel room next to her favorite Dodgers cap and a bag of birdseed. She had been beaten, raped, and strangled. The case is unsolved to this day. In the mid-1980s and early 90s, the Cecil hosted two notorious serial killers. Richard Ramirez, a.k.a. the Night Stalker, stayed on the 14th floor of the hotel during his L.A. murder spree between 1984 and 1985. Ramirez would stash his blood-soaked clothes in the dumpster behind the hotel before sneaking into the back door. Upon receiving the death sentence, execution by gas chamber, at his trial, Ramirez uttered the disturbing words,
"Big deal. Death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland."
Oh Oh my God.
Jesus.
Unbelievable.
He's implying that he's going to haunt Disneyland?
I guess.
Is Richard Ramirez haunting Disneyland right now?
Who's under that Mickey Mouse costume?
Oh my God. That's
when you go through the haunted mansion and one of the ghosts appears in your carriage at the end, there's like a 1 in 999 chance that it's Richard Ramirez.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's brutal. He used to hang out down on Skid Row, and then he'd leave to go murder everybody. I don't know, man. Have you been to this area in downtown LA, Nick?
Where this hotel is? I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure I've seen it.
It's like the apocalypse down there. It's mind blowing.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
It's like an evil version of the community, the transient community. Actually, I shouldn't say this. It's all very judgmental, but it's sort of like a dark version of They Live. Like it's a John Carpenter movie down there for sure.
Yeah, I mean it's some late stage capitalism.
It's very depressed. Yeah, I think if not this specific area, you know, I've definitely driven through or ridden the bus through Skid Row in L.A. And it's very grim. It's a bummer that so many people don't have a place to live, and these gigantic, you know, tent cities have propped up just because there's no other option. It's really depressing.
And the hotel is like the threshold for that area. It's just this horrendously economically depressed area. In 1991, Jack Unterweger, who was a well-known journalist, TV host, and crime writer from Austria, checked into the Cecil under the guise of researching Ramirez and crime in the downtown LA area. Buddying up with the cops, Unterweger went on ride-alongs and interviewed denizens of Skid Row. He ended up sexually assaulting and murdering 3 sex workers, Shannon Exley, Irene Rodriguez, and Peggy Booth, while staying at the Cecil, also on the 14th floor. This motherfucker was a true crime writer, and he was a serial killer.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's called like the Vienna Butcher or something. It's really wild. There should be like a whole true crime podcast about that guy. It's insane. Perhaps the most bizarre tragedy of the Cecil Hotel was the mysterious death of Elisa Lam. In January 2013, Canadian tourist Elisa Lam, a 21-year-old student of the University of British Columbia, was traveling alone on a student's budget when she checked in at the hotel, which had by this point been rebranded as the Stay on Main Hotel and Hostel. Described as sweet and intelligent, Elisa was traveling on her own during a West Coast tour of the U.S. A part-time art and fashion blogger and mental health advocate, Elisa suffered from bipolar disorder, which might explain her erratic behavior captured in an elevator security camera footage from the Cecil Hotel that went viral in 2013. Elisa was on medication and forthcoming about her struggle with mental illness on her Tumblr, which cites this quote from Fight Club author Chuck Palahniuk.
"You're always haunted by the idea you're wasting your life."
He said it so casually.
Yep.
Elisa's parents, immigrants from Hong Kong, were keeping in touch with her every day during her vacation. She routinely called them on a daily basis to let them know where she was and that she was okay. So when they did not hear from her on January 31st, the day Elisa was supposed to check out and head north to Santa Cruz, they contacted the hotel to check in on her whereabouts. Elisa was last seen on January 31st. Hotel staff claimed she was alone. Elisa shopped at the last bookstore where she bought presents for her family. The manager, Katie Orphan, described Elisa as outgoing, lively, and very friendly. In other words, no signs of suicidal ideation. Orphan told CBS LA, "It seemed like she had plans to return home, plans to give things to her family members and reconnect with them." Hotel manager Amy Price informed investigators that Elisa had originally been assigned to a hostel-style room. but was relocated to a private one after her roommates complained of odd behavior. However, there were no real leads to her disappearance. Elisa seemed to simply vanish into thin air. Police found her laptop and personal belongings in her room. So there was a theory that she never left the hotel at all. At least, not by her own will. Elisa's family flew in from Canada to help assist in the search. On February 15th, still no sign of Elisa, police released a roughly 4-minute video that exploded on YouTube, attracting the attention of true crime enthusiasts and conspiracy theorists alike. In the video, captured on the day she disappeared, Elisa is seen walking into an elevator and acting radically. She scans the elevator buttons and cowers in the corner as if hiding from an unseen pursuer. Lamb then starts peeking out of the elevator door before finally stepping out into the hallway. Her hands gesticulate in a strange manner. At one point, she sweeps them across the air repeatedly, as if stroking the back of some large, lumbering, invisible animal. She gestures to an individual outside of the camera's POV before finally stepping out of frame. Now, if you've watched this video, it's really creepy. It's one of the creepiest videos in recent memory. And it looks like she's talking to somebody, but you can't see who it is. You know, some people think that there's some sort of paranormal activity taking place here, that maybe she's seeing someone that's invisible. Obviously, people think that she might be having a manic episode. But it's just a really creepy video. Nick, what were your impressions while watching that?
Yeah, I mean, it's upsetting. I also, I read a little bit about this, that there's some theorizing that there's maybe someone off screen who's
right.
hidden in, you know, perhaps unintentionally, or perhaps the video was manipulated to edit them out.
Yes.
And because I guess there's no timestamp, and so they're not sure how much of it is, you know, how much of it is continuous, if there's a chunk maybe lifted out of the middle when she steps out of frame.
Yes, exactly. Armchair internet sleuths lobbed theories that ranged from a bad drug trip to a mental breakdown to demonic possession. Someone or something had disturbed or frightened Elisa, but what? Conspiracy theorists pointed out that frames of the video seemed to be missing, and at certain points the video was sped up or slowed down, implying a potential cover-up. Then, in the days after the video release, hotel guests started to complain about the water. The front desk was getting complaints that the tap water tasted strange, and in some cases was dark brown or black. A hotel maintenance worker by the name of Santiago Lopez traveled to the top floor of the Cecil, unlocked a door using a special key card to access the stairway to the roof, turned off an alarm that would trigger any unauthorized person's trespass, that trespassed, made a sandwich to distract a Nazi, just kidding, climbed up a ladder to the platform that staged 4 hotel water tanks, lifted one of the tank's 20-pound hatches, and found Lisa's naked body floating there, decomposing in the water. Due to the state of the body, coroners were unable to conduct a full autopsy that would help inform them of foul play. A toxicology report was run, which showed that Elisa had been at least taking some of her prescribed medications, and there were no signs of illegal drugs or intoxicants. But even if something had triggered a manic episode, how did Elisa end up dead and naked in the water tank on the roof of the Cecil Hotel? How did she gain access without triggering alarms or without a key card? In a case as mysterious as this one, there are many theories ranging from murder by an unnamed hotel employee to a paranormal attack. The death was officially ruled a drowning. Elisa's parents filed a wrongful death suit against the hotel, but it was dismissed by Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Howard Hall, who ruled that Elisa's death was unforeseeable because it occurred in an area where guests were not allowed access.
Sadly, Elisa's tragic and mysterious death is just part of a long, dark, and haunted history that has infested a once glamorous hotel in downtown Los Angeles. And that, in a very brief nutshell, is the horrific tale of the Cecil Hotel. Sources for this story include The Unsolved Mystery Behind the Disturbing Death of Elisa Lamb by Natasha Ishak from allthingsinteresting.com. Elisa Lamb drowned in a water tank 3 years ago, but the obsession with her death lives on by Jennifer Swan for vice.com, Wikipedia, and the three-part documentary series Horrors of the Cecil Hotel. Nick Weiger, what the hell is that?
You know what? It's like hearing just the barrage of all the incidents that's happened there over the decades. It's really something. But yeah, the last one that like Riley was saying, I think the Elisa Lamb one is just so like every aspect of it is upsetting. The fact that there's no closure, and then that all the guests were just, you know, bathing in this tainted water.
Yeah, that water tank ran all the way down to like the coffee shop. So like all the coffee was being glued with it. Like everyone was ingesting or bathing in that water.
So gnarly.
It's terrifying. And it's so sad. And, you know, this is like a real person that this happened to.
Right.
And all of these people, you go to the Wikipedia and there is a list like the length of my arm of just everyone who has died in that hotel. And, you know, you have to assume that. Sure, there's people that die in areas all the time that we don't hear about, but just the amount of suicides that were happening after the Great Depression and during the Great Depression at that hotel were alarming.
Yes.
I'm shocked that they didn't like erect nets at the bottom, you know, to catch people, as grim as it was. But it's a weird, you know, it's one of these places that's on all the ghost tours. In downtown LA, it's a famous one of the famous haunted hotels of Los Angeles, and we seem to have a lot of them.
Right.
I don't know. Do you guys think it's possible that maybe this place just exists on a dark crossroads, that there's just bad energy down there? What is this?
I'm open to that possibility. I mean, especially considering like Skid Row around it and everything, there's just like so much suffering in that area, and there's been so much suffering in that hotel. And it's just like it maybe it's like creates a feedback loop where it just compounds on itself and amplifies, you know, this very dark energy. And, you know, maybe it is possible that people are driven mad in that space, you know?
Yeah, I think the other way you could view the feedback loop sort of theory is that maybe if someone has, you know, thoughts of suicide or some, you know, they might, and or maybe they have some. It sounds like, you know, that true crime writer psychopath like probably was perhaps drawn to this place because of its reputation. So there could be some of that as well.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Wasn't the American Horror Story Hotel season based on this?
Yes, it was. And it was it received a lot of backlash because there was a lot of critics who were like, you're taking this like economically destitute area and you're turning it into this sort of like glamorous horror story or glorified horror story. But yeah, it is based on that. And then this is interesting, Nick. I found this. You might find this. This is from... I think this is from that All Things Interesting article. I'm just going to read directly from this quote. More recently, a gaming studio came under fire after users of the game Y2K, a postmodern RPG, found undeniable resemblances to Lamb's case in the storyline. In one scene of the game, main character Alex receives a video file showing another character, Sammy, in an elevator. The elevator door opens to reveal an alternate dimension on the other side. Sammy is then captured by a demon, kicking and screaming all the while.
Wow. Yeah, that just seems like that's in poor taste.
I didn't know if you'd ever heard of that game or not.
No, I'm not aware of it.
Y2K. And then there's this other theory that Vice had that...
Sorry, real quick. This incident happened in like 2010 or something, right?
Yes, 2013, which I don't know why this says why this game was Y2K postmodern. It must have been created since 2013. Let me look. I'm going to Google it right now. We'll take a look.
Because I was going to say, because unless this is another thing, like they, you know, people were saying Dark Water maybe had eerie resemblances to this, but happened before the incident, was released before the incident. Unless this is one of those, it's just like, why are you making a game called Y2K in the 2010s?
Well, it's so apparently it's a Japanese RPG style game that takes place in the 90s.
Oh, okay, that makes a little more sense. Throwback.
The storyline must revolve around an alternate version of whatever happened on Y2K.
Got it.
It's about eight strangers, a mysterious woman who vanishes in an elevator, and the supernatural. So clearly, this is like heavily influenced by this story. One of the other theories was that she may have had tuberculosis. I read this in the vice.com because there was an outbreak of tuberculosis in downtown LA at the time. One of the reasons I bring it up is that there's a weird synchronistic crossover here, that the test to identify tuberculosis is called Lam ELISA.
That's
how strange is that?
Weird connection.
It's her name reversed.
Yeah, that. But I mean, what?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's just a weird synchronicity. I don't know. It's just one of those.
I just can't get past the door, the locked door, the alarm, the difficult to open hatch, right. The lock. It's just like, how?
That's why I think someone from the hotel probably was following her and was involved, and that the hotel either covered it up or that person got away with it.
Yeah, because that completely ties in with the footage being manipulated. I mean, someone who would have access to all these things, you know, if there was a culprit behind this, it wasn't a suicide.
Yeah, allegedly. I was going to say that. So
yeah, very allegedly.
We don't get sued by Stay on Main.
In this alleged, theoretical, then the guy that goes and finds her is like the perfect fall guy, because like he has the key and everything to open the door. And so it's like, or maybe, you know, I'm sure he was a suspect.
Yeah.
At some point.
Who knows? It's all creepy. Well, expect more scary stories like that all month long here on Bigfoot Collectors Club as we celebrate horror stories. Nick Weiger, man, what a delight. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. You are such a great guest. Bigfoot we don't know where to find Bigfoot. Where can people find Nick Weiger?
You know, I'm just my name on any social media platform, Nick Weiger, and then NICKWIGER. And then, check out my podcast, Doughboys, a podcast about chain restaurants, co-hosted with my friend Mike Mitchell. And How Did This Get Played, where we review and discuss the worst and weirdest video games of all time with Heather Ann Campbell and Matt Apodaca. Check out either of those or both of those.
Check them out both. I can subscribe to both. So can you. Definitely follow us on Bigfoot Pod on Twitter, Bigfoot Collectors Club on Instagram. Do us a favor. Go to Apple Podcasts. Please give us a 5-star review. If you give us one in a brief little review, then we might read it right here, like this one that says, "Fantastic Paranormal Podcast, 5 stars by Stormtrooper Gab. My favorite part about BCC is that Reverend Steve Newland is entertaining me with a paranormal goodness with paranormal goodness each week." Wow, thank you, a little True Blood reference, appropriate for the Halloween season. Vampires, sorry, Nick, vampires are not real.
I know.
But maybe once you get on the other side, you can program some vampires into the great simulation that we're all taking place in.
I'll add them, and then I'll make sure, as I prefer to call them, they'll be, everyone will know them as Draculas.
Fantastic. All right, everybody, that wraps up another episode. Bryce Johnson will be back next week. Until then, good night.
And go get regressed.
All right.
Bigfoot Collectors Club is produced by Riley Bray. Our theme song is Come Alone by Sun Eaters, courtesy of Lotus Pool Records. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the podcast to more listeners. To support the show, Check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Bigfoot Collectors Club and unlock multiple reward episodes every month.
Hey guys, Heather Ashley here, host of the Big Mad True Crime Podcast. If you're looking for a true crime podcast with all of the details and none of the small talk, you have found your people. Each week, we dive deep into a new case and learn everything there is to know, from getting to know the victim and the impact their case has had on those around them, to the investigation into what happened to them and who is or might be responsible. And if the bad guy looks like he might drink whiskey by a dumpster or has the social skills of an ogre, we say it because we were all thinking it anyway. As the name suggests, we get big mad over true crime, and I would love to have you join our incredible community of listeners with big hearts and zero time for small talk. Subscribe to Big Mad True Crime anywhere you listen to podcasts and listen to new episodes every single Monday.
Hey, this is Eric Molinsky, host of the podcast Imaginary Worlds. Each episode, I explore different sci-fi fantasy genres, talking with filmmakers, novelists, game designers, cosplayers, comic book artists, and anyone who works in the field of make-believe. I also look at the fan experience, asking, why do we suspend our disbelief? You can subscribe to Imaginary Worlds wherever you get your podcasts.